The part I laughed the hardest at was just this throwaway image of the marquee that said Too Short, Third Eye Blind, and Kehlani.
Yes!
Were playing. And I was like, if that ain't some perfect Oakland shit.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 37, and I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian. And I'm joined by my fellow co-hosts, Ebony Astor.
What's up?
And Carolyn Pettit.
Hello.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. Or, alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. In today's show, we're going to talk about the exciting new film out of Oakland called Blindspotting. And, as always, we'll finish the show by all sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Exclusively for our fantastic backers, we've got an action-packed bonus segment. If you want access to our bonus segment and other fun perks, join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now on with the show. What's up?
It's Monday. Yeah. I don't know. Do people know this? Have we pulled back the curtain on this that we record on Monday morning?
Oh, actually, I tweeted about it this morning and I was like,
oh,
hey,
you did.
You know, about to record the Femfreak podcast. Yeah. What bullshit am I going to say this week? No one knows.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, we all always look forward to finding out.
Me too, because it's a mystery to
Ebony,
me as well.
I think there's a, you know, like our fan wiki, the Feminist Frequency Radio fan wiki, like there's a running tally of facts Ebony gets wrong in each episode.
And that section just keeps getting longer and longer. Yeah. And I just want to say thank you to the people who are maintaining that.
The diligent people who scour every episode looking for incorrect things that Ebony says. Yeah, yes.
But for real though, like Anita got some random tweet from, you know, one of the Twitterati talking about like, oh, blah, blah, blah. I don't really, like I listen to this podcast, although sometimes they drive me bonkers because they get a lot of geek stuff wrong. And
wait, really?
Yeah. I remember this because I remember thinking like, dude, we do get a lot of stuff wrong, but I was immediately fascinated. Like, I wonder what in particular set this dude off.
Okay, but we also like, don't get a lot of stuff
well,
wrong.
Well, that's it, no, too, because, you know?
Like, well, no, but in Ghost in the Shell, like, it, you know, it's not really, like, she's not really taking an Asian role because she's, like, a robot who's, like, supposed to look white, but, you know, it's so it's not, you keep calling it something and it's not that at all.
Yeah, so I was just like, I wonder what it was. What was the, like, you know, final straw for this dude? Or is he just hate listening every week? Which, yo, hey, thanks for boosting our numbers. You know, just to be like, they got this wrong, and they got this wrong, and they don't know this about the Star Wars extended universe, and they got that wrong.
I mean, the point here is that, like, women are the pressure on us to be perfect all the time and get everything right all the time is way higher than that of, like, men,
absolutely.
Right? And so, you know, like, yeah, we probably get a couple of facts wrong occasionally, like everybody else who does live recordings of things and talks off the cuff.
I mean, I used to listen to the Giant Bombcast, very entertaining podcast with like Jeff Gerstmann and Brad Shoemaker and, you know, other folks. And like, those dudes don't know everything about video games. Like, and they will sometimes say stuff that's wrong and nobody like pounces on them and is like, you fake game guys
or
whatever.
Show us your gamer cred.
But this level of scrutiny on women when they talk about those same areas of culture is it's on another level. You're absolutely right.
I am right.
Yeah.
Take that, internet commenter.
Wow. Getting something right to start off the show. We're doing good.
Anita 1, internet 0.
That's right. All right, Carol. Okay. What's happened this week?
Oh, so much that I can't cover all of it, so I'm trying to pick and choose some of the gems. All right, so let's talk about, you know, adventures in being black in Hollywood.
This is
a comedy.
Be so good.
Comedy cavalcade, Ebony. It's it's not at all, unfortunately. But so a young actor named Anna Diop. Her last name is Diop. I've never heard it said out loud, so I don't know how to pronounce it. I apologize.
I believe it is Diop.
Okay, it's what Ebony just said. She has been cast as Starfire in a TV series called Titans. It's a DC series, and Starfire is a DC Comics character who is like orange. She's like an orange alien. As Alex Abad Santos describes her in a piece for Vox, Starfire is a female alien with creamsicle-colored skin and a mane of scarlet hair. Anna Diop, the actor, is black. After a trailer was played at Comic-Con this past week, a resurgence of racist anger and hatred about this black woman playing an orange alien comic book character flooded her Instagram feed, and she has since shut it down and I think has minimized her social media presence in general. And, like, this is not, of course, the first time something like this has happened, but it really makes me think that when white, and I'm speaking in broad general terms, but, like, the sort of people who would attack her over this, when those, like, particular white comic book fans read a comic book and they encounter a character like Starfire, who, again, is an orange alien...
What color is she?
A creamsicle. Creamsicle. I really believe that on some level, unconsciously, they sort of imbue the character with an intrinsic kind of whiteness that, you know, and they other black people and other people of color to such an extent that casting a person of color in that role, you know, it is like jarring and wrong to them, even though the character is not.
Which is hilarious because oftentimes alien, like the metaphor of the alien is of the other.
Yeah, right.
So it has its own like problematic shit.
Sure, totally. But it would make sense to think of an alien as not white, as an other of some, you know, whatever intersection that might be. But also, like, we see this over and over again with different, especially books that turn into movies, where the reader just assumed a character was white, whether the text said otherwise. And so, remember with Hunger Games?
Yeah.
And I'm totally forgetting the
Amanda Stenberg. Yeah, Amanda Stenberg.
Yeah. And, like, we see this, and that's not the most recent example, but it happens again and again.
Yeah.
I was going to say the same thing. Like, you've got a multitude of things going on. But, you know, as Caro suggests, like, audience are so unaccustomed to having to, like, empathize with and being able to like characters who are different from themselves, white audiences, right? That they assume that if they like a character, that character must also be white, despite any textual evidence to the contrary. And because whiteness is given this kind of like, it occupies this default category where it's unraced, right? But it speaks to like this profound narcissism among white audiences that in the whole of the universe, the expectation is that, yeah, these aliens might be alien, but they're white aliens, right? You know? And I mean, as much as I love my foundational iconic geek properties, you know, things like Star Wars and Star Trek and, you know, Doctor Who, like it plays upon these same things, such that the aliens that, you know, the heroes come across are to a greater or lesser extent, nevertheless, white coded aliens.
You know, the thing about this, like, outrage bullshit that keeps happening every year, like, is it the same crew of people over and over and over again making a massive stink? Like, are we giving, like, one, the harassment that they, it's a lot of people, right? Mostly men. But the harassment that they spew is aggressive and toxic and really difficult to deal with as the target of it and also watching it. But also, like, it's the same people who are pissed off about the same thing again and again and again, and they're fucking wrong, and they're causing such a huge, they're causing so much pain and conflict conflict's not the right word. I don't even know what I'm trying to say. It's Monday morning. I'm tired. But, like, it's just as we're sitting here talking about this, I'm like, every week I feel like we're talking about people being outraged at diversity,
yeah,
right, and inclusion in media. And it's the same fucking people again and again. And we're spending so much energy on these people because they are taking up so much goddamn space.
Yeah, they're sucking up all the energy and all the air in the room. One of the elements to this particular story about Starfire is that, and that's going, you know, pretty unremarked except among black women, is the role that colorism is playing specifically. So, you know, you have people revealing their discomfort with a dark skinned black woman specifically, playing someone who was, you know, going to be a love interest, who is going to be a heroine, you know, someone who's going to be a main character. And so you will have these people explicitly say, like, you know, the issue for me is that she's so dark. Like, why couldn't they get a biracial actress or someone who's a bit lighter? Like, just straight up with that kind of, you know, colorist, racist nonsense. And, you know, as I said, unfortunately, I'm not hearing too many people who aren't black women pointing this out, but it's something that is so rife and so endemic in Hollywood that for all the many gains that black women may or may not have made in Hollywood, the fact is, for every, you know, black woman you see, the number of dark-skinned black women that you see, you can count on like one hand. It's horrible. It's ridiculous. And so, and that's a huge part of the reaction that Anna Diop is getting, is that it's not only that she's black, but that she is a dark-skinned black woman.
Definitely. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. In better superhero news, exciting stuff for all you Marvel fans out there, guess who's coming to the MCU after a massive merger deal between Fox and Disney? We've got Wolverine, Doctor Doom, Annihilus, the Sentinels, Mole Man, Magneto, Deadpool, Sabretooth, Galactus, Silver Surfer, the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, Apocalypse, the X-Men, the Fantastic Four. Aren't giant corporate mergers the best?
Wow. Yeah.
Like, all of the, like, so many of the stories in comic book and geek sort of websites and spaces about this merger are just, like, big celebrations of, like, all the Marvel characters are coming home to the MCU, yay! And, like, do you have any idea how awful these, like, giant, you know, increasingly massive, like, entertainment monopolies, how bad this is? Like, it's
and also, just, like, if you want news stories, new superheroes, fucking good luck, because we're just going to be seeing the same characters over and over again ad infinitum.
I want to see a spoof skit of the meeting in which they discuss the different characters and who owns what and, like, negotiating for certain characters, because that's got to be the dumbest shit to see, because it's all, like, legal bullshit of, like, but with these, like, goofy ass names. I'm picturing that. It's just so
Like, these, like, men in suits probably, you know, have no idea who Apocalypse is, right? But they're like, well, how much money will we make? You know, like, how much mind share does Apocalypse have as a character? Like, do we want, you know, whatever, like, those kinds of discussions about, like, boiling these characters down to dollars and cents.
Yeah, totally. All right, should we head into the main topic for the week?
Yeah.
We're going to discuss Blindspotting, which is a film from Devi Diggs and Rafael Casal. It's a comedy and drama that dives into gentrification and identity that is intensely rooted in Oakland. It is the most Oakland ever.
Didn't we have this conversation a few weeks ago? Didn't we already do the Oakland do the Oakland movie?
It is bizarre that these movies came out back to back that are both deeply Oakland, but
they're so different. I mean, like, yeah, they're so different.
We're talking about Sorry to Bother You.
Yes, a few weeks ago we did an episode on Sorry to Bother You, a brilliant comedy satire set in Oakland, and this is a very different film that's also Oakland to the core, very vital, and they're both, like, very much essential and worth seeing, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I've seen the movie twice, and I went to see it last night again, but MoviePass was down, and I was like, well, fuck it, I've already seen the movie twice, I'm not gonna pay to see it again. I fucking love this movie.
It's so good. I mean, so let's, you know, just lay the groundwork for the premise here a little bit.
Yeah,
is you have these two main characters. You have Devi Diggs, who some may be familiar with because he was a star in Hamilton.
I think he won a Tony for
Won a Tony for Hamilton. So he plays Colin, his best friend, played by Rafael Casal, who is named Miles. Rafael Casal, for those who aren't familiar with him, is white. And the film is so very concerned with the friendship between these two people who have grown up in Oakland together. And, you know, right from the very beginning, near the beginning, there is a scene in which the two of them are just kind of walking together, you know, late at night, and they start like rapping and like dropping rhymes and like improvising, freestyling together. And I thought that that is such a brilliant scene to establish for us, like, the depths of the friendship between these two characters. They know each other's rhythms. They've obviously been, like, because the film cannot take time to tell the story of their developing friendship. It's like, we have to go in knowing that these two people are, like, have been lifelong friends. And I think that that initial scene, it does such a great job of establishing that for us as they, yeah, like, they freestyle about their lives, the job that they do together, like moving. They work for a moving company and stuff.
Well,
like
so
that.
So yeah, and also so the base here is that Miles, Colin,
yes,
who's black.
Colin,
if
yes.
The race is really important, which is why Carolyn mentioned it. I'm repeating it.
Yeah.
Colin, who is black, has 3 days left on his probation, and Miles is, who's white, is just like a big fuck up and is kind of like always getting in trouble and kind of like, you just think that everything is going to fall apart for him at every single moment. One of the things that I think this film does really well is it balances comedy and drama in what I think is very tightly woven together, where like, it is a serious film about serious stuff and it's funny as hell.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and they're able to bring in and poke fun at a lot of things while also like being like, yeah, gentrification sucks. And like, we don't know who we are in these spaces and we're just trying to get by and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And an essential part of the plot too, is that very early on in the film, it's not a spoiler, Colin witnesses while he's alone, like driving back to the like, halfway house or whatever you call it, like while he's the place where he's still staying while he's on probation, he sees a black man get, you know, shot in the back by a police officer, shot and killed. And it obviously like shakes him, you know, to the core, but he is a black man himself with like, again, 3 days left on his parole. What power does he have to do anything with that information, right? And the news stories about the killing, like, at one point, Miles is at home watching the story on the news. The victim is shown in, like, I think orange prison garb or something. And, you know, like, depicted as a criminal, like, Miles comments, like, oh, how disrespectful of them. They couldn't find another photo of him than that one. And, you know, he kind of sadly comments, well, no protests for you, homie, or something like that, because like there's no outcry about this particular incident. There's nobody there who saw it except Colin. I know, I keep wanting to mix up their names too, except Colin. And so, you know, nothing is done about this terrible, terrible crime committed by a police officer. Ebony, did you see the movie?
I am here. I didn't want to step on anything. Yeah, I saw the film yesterday, and from the very beginning, Carol, you and I have talked about this a little bit on Cinema Ball.
Cinema Ball, hey.
But I am so grateful for and in love with directors who know how to light brown skin. So there's that magical scene, which is, you know, meant to evoke a kind of, you know, otherworldly space when Miles, Colin, and their friend, whose name I'm forgetting, in his high rider car are, you know, just lit by this beautiful kind of like interior blue and purple neon light. And, you know, they're skinning up and they're eating from the newly gentrified Quickway burger stand. And it's just this hilarious moment among friends, right? But I wasn't even paying attention too much to what they were saying because I was just so in love with how beautiful Colin and his friends' faces looked. it's so rare that black skin gets the opportunity to shine on screen, to be just fully three-dimensional on screen in the same way that, like, it's so rare for black characters to be fully realized on screen and on our narratives. So, I mean, just from the very beginning, like, I was so excited. You know, when you know that, like, you're in the hands of a director and a cast who intimately know, you know, how to kind of fully flesh out a person, a place, a moment. You know, I was just, I was on board from the very beginning. I have to say, though, as the movie progressed, I found myself, because I'm a hater and because I'm a profound misanthrope, I found myself caring less and less about Colin as a character. And I hate that I'm even saying this out loud, because y'all know David Diggs and I have been happily married for 10 years now. He is my love, my husband. Never want to say anything against him. But I found myself being so annoyed by him, partially because of his age. I'm not sure what age his character is supposed to be, but the kind of, like, naive way he hesitant way he moves through the world rang false to me at moments, because I thought, like, dude, you were born and grew up in Oakland. There's no way any of this would just be being born in upon you now. You know, there's no way you would need your girlfriend, your mother, you know, someone at a party to kind of emphasize these points to you, such that, you know, it's just hitting you now in this way at this age. Like, there were parts of it where I was just like, this would have worked better for me if Colin was more clearly presented as a character who was, like, you know, 21 or something, as opposed to late 20s.
I wonder if some of that, you know, so they actually wrote the screenplay when they were young.
Right,
so
right.
Yeah, the two of them are actually like lifelong Oakland friends, from what I understand. And yeah, they wrote the screenplay like 10 years ago, and, like, obviously didn't have the wherewithal then to get it produced. So
I also, I mean, I'm a lot more forgiving of that, because that's just like trying to give information to the audience and, like, figuring out creative ways to do that. I think that. I think Raphael did such an amazing job.
Oh, he was fantastic.
He really overshadowed Devi Diggs in this film. And, like, they're both great, and sure, I think they play off each other well, but, like, I think this is Raphael's, like, huge coming out in terms of, like, being a fucking star.
I hope so. I'd love to see him in more stuff.
Absolutely. And I think that his character was more entertaining to watch in a lot of ways, because of which had to be because of who his character was, but he nailed it.
And I think that actually, it, to some degree, plays into the themes of the film. Like, maybe because he's white, he has freedom to be bigger, you know, to draw more attention to himself in ways that, you know, might be dangerous for Colin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, you know, Miles would be out on the street just, like, straight up hustling, whether it's the sailboat, which that whole scene was amazing, or when he's in the beauty salon, you know, trying to hawk those flat irons, which was a scene that worked a lot less well for me. But, you know, yeah, he is allowed to be kind of, like, hyperbolic and draw outside of the lines in a way that, yeah, you know, like, Colin knows he can't draw attention to himself in that way, both because he is, like, you know, a big black man with braids, which is, you know, a conversation they have later on in the film, but also because he is a convicted felon. Like, he does not have the safety of navigating the world in the same way that Miles does. And so Miles has, like, these existential crises. And so he talks about, like, you know, the effects of gentrification on his spirit, because he's like, yo, I'm from Oakland too. You know, like, this is my home. These are my people. And yet, to look at me, you know, I get, you know, lumped in with the gentrifiers, with the colonizers. And it's like, okay, well, cry me a river, Miles. But yeah, you know, like, he recognizes in some part that, like, there's a performance element to what he does, because he wants his allegiances to be, you know, kind of clearly marked.
So I actually had some, I mean, my feelings about it are complicated, but I had some sympathy for Miles with regard to that, because, so, I think a lot of what this film is about thematically is the ways in which we are seen and the ways in which we are misseen, like the ways in which all of us all the time, to some degree, people look at us and they see us in ways that are false, or they attribute things, you know, based on sort of cultural baggage or what have you. You know, there's a metaphor in the film of the image that, you know, I'm sure we've all seen at one time or another, that you can either see like a vase or you can see like two faces kind of facing each other, but you can't see both at the same time. It's, you know, the sort of optical trick. And like, without going too much into spoiler specifics, like, there are genuine issues for Miles, who is like Oakland, right? He has been Oakland his whole life. And then, you know, you do have like some tech people and stuff, gentrifiers coming in, adopting this kind of Oakland pride, right? Like to the nth degree, like wearing this kind of performative, like, we love Oakland. And to the point where what sometimes can happen is that those people are seen as like the genuine article, like as far as like white Oaklanders. And whereas Miles is seen as, you know, a quote unquote culture vulture, like, that is to me so like thorny and complicated. And I don't know.
So I actually was like, I had issue with the fact that Miles was this white dude who's just like, I'm basically adopting all of black culture.
Sure.
And I wear a grill and sure. I talk a certain way and I dress a certain way and I'm, you know, whatever. And I was like, what are they doing here? What does that mean? And I'm so glad the film actually deals with that,
yeah.
At least to some degree, right? Maybe not to the same degree in which we would talk about cultural appropriation, but one of my favorite scenes in the movie is directly addressing and confronting that between Colin and Miles, and the tension between the two friends in terms of like how Miles gets away with so much shit and how Colin just wants to like be okay. He wants to not have all of the attention that comes with being a black dude with braids, or just a black dude in general, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a scene where Colin is walking slowly, you know, he wound up with a gun for, you know, reasons. So he's got this gun, and if he's stopped by the police with a gun, obviously, like, that's, he's going to go, you know, go back to prison, presumably. And I mean, you just feel the tension, like, as the police are kind of scrutinizing him, and you can't, you know, you cannot help but be aware that their reaction,
it was Miles' gun. The idea is that, like, if it was Miles walking down the street, the cop wouldn't have stopped.
Exactly.
Him.
Yeah.
Or so, wouldn't have considered stopping him.
Right. And, well, that's why, you know, I appreciate the way, you know, the film is very nuanced as it kind of, you know, unpacks the blossom of like Oakland and who lives there and who gets to inhabit what spaces. You know, when it comes to Miles, a character that, again, I loved, but, you know, the tension that exists within him about the way he's perceived, both by, you know, residents of Oakland, like longtime residents of Oakland, and, you know, newcomers, I was like, yeah, dude, I get that you don't want to be perceived as a hipster. I get that you don't want to be perceived as, you know, a gentrifier. I get that. But the consequences for you having to inhabit that identity and be perceived that way are much less than the consequences that exist for someone like Colin, right? So that's why, you know, it wasn't that I wasn't, you know, that I was unsympathetic to what Miles was expressing, but I do think that the film takes pains to point out that, like, sucks for you, you know, Miles, but then also, you know, like, going back to that crucial scene between Miles and Colin after the party, I don't want to spoil too much, because I think it's the way the film unfolds such that, like, for instance, we don't find out why Colin is on probation. We don't know what his crime was until what? Maybe the midpoint of the film. And I think it's crucial that we don't find out until then, because if we had known, we would understand his character a bit differently, you know? But I think, you know, Anita, as when you're talking about how you know, Colin just wants to, you know, exist and not constantly have a spotlight shown on him and have a role pre-written for him that he just has to, he has to perform. Part of what didn't resonate with me about Colin's character is the way in which he was so profoundly reactive and seemingly unable to admit his own culpability. So at the end, when, you know, he and Val, his ex-girlfriend, talk about their blind spots and her blind spot in relation to him, I was like, yeah, dude, I get it. But you, part of why you are where you are is because of actions you have taken. You know, like, not all of this was something that was put upon you. You know, he just, there was something so passive about the way he understood where he was. And I was like, no, there's a way in which you need to understand, like, your own culpability here.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. But I also feel like I also personally really value the film's, what I see as part of the film's point about the way that we can reduce people when we look at them. Like, the way that Val has, since Colin went to prison and was on parole, like, she has a tendency to kind of reduce him to a certain thing, right, when she looks at him and not see the full person. And that doesn't mean that he doesn't bear any responsibility for that. Like, he absolutely does. I love the complexity of this film.
I do want to talk about police.
Yeah.
So, you know, Colin sees this cop shoot a black dude, like, right in front of him. And the other piece of this film is trauma. It's trauma. It's about, like, finding your voice, being able to speak your feelings and speak to other people.
Spoiler alert.
They were on Earth all along.
So spoilers for the very end, because I want to mention something specific here. At the very end, Colin happens to be in the house of this cop and is like, holy shit. And he kind of, like, gets really, really emotional and, like, really, like, traumatized and horrified. He's in the house. He's confronting him.
Specifically the cop who committed the murder at the beginning of the film.
Played by Ethan Embry.
Is that who that was?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was. And so Colin does this whole thing, storms out, and Miles is just standing there looking at the wreckage of the what just happened. Nope, everyone's alive. Spoilers, I already said spoilers. And the cop says, who's clearly upset about what he has done in the film. He's upset about what he's done. And he says to Colin, I didn't mean to. And Miles, Jesus, yeah. I'm sorry I can't get their names right. And Miles says, are you sure?
Yeah.
And that's it. So here's the thing about this, and what I want to bring up is that, like, it is critically important to not, like, humanize cops who murder like black men, black people on the streets. And so there's this moment in this where, like, it almost is humanizing them. And, like, I think the are you sure is supposed to indicate, like, yeah, but you're still a part of this larger system. Like, are you, like, you know, whatever. But I don't feel like, I feel iffy about that whole thing.
See, I love that it ended on the are you sure, because, you know.
Well, I'm glad the are you sure was there. I just don't know if it was enough.
It was for me, because we see more of the cop. Than just him crying and just his fear, you know, and his guilt over the shooting, right? I mean, for me anyway, like, the fact that his wife is leaving him and taking his child, I just felt like we were getting more of a picture of, you know, a guy who's affect in his world maybe isn't the most stable, you know? And so to have that quiet rejoinder from Miles worked for me to offset the dude's tears. I don't know. For me, it worked, you know, and I thought it was very important, because I think so many times when this happens, you know, the people responsible are like, you know, we were afraid, you know, we would never have done this, you know, in hindsight or whatever. And it was like, no, the end result of, you know, the system of policing that we have is always the murder and eradication of people of color, of people from vulnerable communities. So, like, I don't know, it worked for me.
Yeah, I could, I, I really wish we hadn't gotten those shots of him, like, crying. Like, I don't give a fuck about your tears. And, like,
right.
he has a Blue Lives Matter placard in his garage and everything. Like, he obviously does not fucking get it, like, at all. I mean, obviously, just the fact that he committed this horrible act communicates that. But then, like, yeah, I wish that it had not even humanized him to the extent that it does, personally.
Or if they had just not said anything. Like, the guy didn't say, like, if the cop hadn't said, I didn't mean to. Like, if he hadn't said anything, it would have also been different.
Yeah.
Right? But we get to hear him say, I didn't mean to. Which are we supposed to take ironic? Like, we watched him do it.
Right.
Right? Like, so we know that he did it and there wasn't a need for it.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about all
I mean,
that.
To the film's credit, and I don't want to be specific because I think it's so powerful in its kind of spontaneity, but there is an image, like, very late in the film that drives home the toll of the human toll of violence that has ravaged Oakland. And it is, like, so, to me, that was just so devastating and so powerful. I was really grateful for the film to acknowledge the larger issue of that in this story about Oakland.
Before we wrap up, I do want to talk about women. So
yeah.
I think with both Sorry to Bother You and Blindspotting, women are not very important in the film, and like. Part of me is like, that's okay because it is a film about a specific story and whatever. But also, I just kind of want to acknowledge that. Like, they play a very small role. And so Val is played by Janita Gavankar, who I'm going to say is a friend of the podcast, even though she's never been on it, but I'm going to get her on it one day.
What,
so,
you can do that? Right. You got that kind of hand?
Yeah,
nice.
She's a friend of mine. If you're in gaming, you would know her from playing. In Battlefront 2, she played it. Urso.
Oh my God! Of course, I didn't even make that connection.
She was on two E3s ago. She was the host at E3 wearing that amazing dress.
I didn't even realize that was her.
Janita.
Oh, wow!
But and then Ashley was played by Jasmine Cephas Jones, and I didn't realize this until I was at an event for the film, and someone was like, "Don't you think it was weird that Ashley's character, who Ashley is, is Miles's wife and they have a kid together. She's like, don't you think it's weird that you only ever see her in the house? And I was like, oh my God, I didn't even notice that because she was so good. Like, she was so good in that role. But like, the women are periphery. They're just there for like...
Yeah, I mean, it is another film. And again, I like this film, but it is another film in which the women, whether it's, you know, Colin's mother, whether it's Val, whether it's Ashley, are, you know, tools for the male characters to achieve some sort of like, you know, psychological rapprochement or some sort of emotional growth, you know, but as characters are in their own right. And also, again, you know, let me just say, I'm getting a little bit tired of films in which I am supposed to take a journey with a male character who needs to slowly come to some sort of realization about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I'm just like, I'm tired, y'all. Also, can I get some dark-skinned sisters up in a film about Oakland, please?
Yeah.
Well, it also bothered me that Val was like, she was trying to take away Colin's blackness. Like, she was like, you got to change your hair. You take out your grill. You got to this. You got to that. And I'm like, that's not the problem. Like, Val's role is to, like, sometimes Val says things that are useful and smart. But it felt a lot like Val was trying to be like, you need to be more white. And you need to be, and not that Val is white, but like, that you need to be more presentable to white America.
It's very much like, you know, like a kind of respectability politics. Like, your blackness is not the problem. It's the version of blackness. Although I have to say, I do think that the film itself traffics in that a bit when, you know, in that crucial scene, again, with Colin and Miles, when Colin is telling him, I was like, you know, call me a nigger. And he's making this point that based upon like actions alone, you know, Miles himself is the one who should be considered nigger. And I'm like, no, the category itself is fucked up. Let's start there. You know, like it's like that old Chris Rock bit. Like even black people hate niggers. It's like, no, that shit is problematic on its face. There's no like category of nigger that is inhabited by anyone. We need to all, you know, get divorced from that shit. You know, so I think there's a way in which the film itself kind of, you know, plays with that kind of respectability, you know, politics. Like there's a set of behaviors that are not right that, you know, have been coded a certain way. And we don't want to do that. And that has been a very racialized category.
Yeah, totally. All right. One last thing I want to say real quick is Utkarsh Ambukar. Sorry.
Yo,
he's
price
in it for
of admission
scene.
Alone. That scene, and price of admission alone.
His scene, so he's the one that tells you why Colin was arrested and thrown in jail. And I found out, so after you watch this, you're going to be like, holy shit. I found out that that scene, he like 90% of it was improvised.
Holy
like
shit.
He just fucking freestyled that whole thing. Oh. And it's so good.
It is
so good.
So magical.
So shout out to him. Yeah. Go check out Blindspotting. Support the film. We are it's media critics. We're going to be critical of it, but it's still really good.
And
definitely,
yeah, I mean,
definitely.
It's complicated in worthwhile ways, right? Like it's got so much going on, and even if some of those things are flaws, they're interesting, thought provoking flaws. Not like
I feel like it's one of those films that's an important film that's also really entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Like go fucking see it.
I don't think we didn't say enough about how funny it is.
It's so funny.
I really quickly want to mention. So Ebony mentioned how they have the food from like the Quickway, like the newly gentrified Quickway, and like there's a point at which like Miles is like has a burger. But he's eating, and it's like, but it's a vegan burger, and he's like, he gets upset, and then you hear an employee be like, oh, sorry, did you want meat? You have to specify that you want meat.
Died.
It's like if everything's like flipped around
it's
now
so
to like.
I have to say though that like the part I laughed the hardest at was just this throwaway image of the marquee that said Too Short, Third Eye Blind, and Kehlani.
Yes!
We're playing. And I was like, if that ain't some perfect Oakland shit, I don't know what. Like, it was so spot on.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It was real good. All right, go check out the film. It's in theaters now. It's great. All right. Do we have a jingle for What's Your Freakout?
Well, we've had songs at times when you have sort of freestyled a little.
Well, Ebony has.
No, even there was at least one time where you did, and then Phil lay down some
I'm
rhythms.
Just saying, I think we need a transitional like song, a little ditty.
Okay.
A little,
all right.
Damn it!
What's your freakout?
Damn it!
What's your freakout?
I'm gonna lay down something that Phil can lay down some tracks that Phil can work with. You know, just
drop some.
We
bars,
gotta get Utkarsh to do some freestyling for us on this podcast.
There you go. There you go.
Okay, Carolyn, what is your freakout this week?
So my freakout is a manga called My Solo Exchange Diary by Kabi Nagata. Previously on the podcast, long ago, I believe, I talked about a. Kabi Nagata's previous book, the one that really put her on the map and kind of exploded in the public consciousness, which is called My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness. And this is a follow-up to that, a direct follow-up, My Solo Exchange Diary. The title, My Solo Exchange Diary, refers to the fact that it's based around a diary that she writes back and forth to herself. What these books do that to me is so powerful and extraordinary is they really, really just lay bare the experience of profound loneliness in all of its emotional and physical and psychological pain. The narratives are very specific, like that they, you know, they're autobiographical. She draws very much from her own life. So in My Solo Exchange Diary, there's a lot of stuff about how the success of My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness did and did not like affect her life. and, you know, stuff with her relationships with her parents. It gets into family trauma and expectations. But really, like, she just has, I think, a gift for writing about and illustrating, of course, because they're manga, like, for illustrating the experience of loneliness at its kind of deepest and most sort of debilitating and intense. And it's, you know, there's something kind of cathartic about it, but there's also, it just cuts, you know, it cuts right to the heart of that experience. And in a way that's welcoming, it's humanizing, it's vulnerable. That's my freak out. My Solo Exchange Diary by Kabi Nagata.
Nice. Ebony, what's your freak out?
So last week, I think it was last week, I mentioned that I am a hardcore romance fan. And so since then, people have been hitting me up and were like, oh, I hear you write romance. You know, like, where can we check it out? You can't check it out nowhere. It exists in my Google Drive. That's it. But I do read a lot of shit. And so my freak out this week is a shout out to Rebecca Weatherspoon, who is an amazing writer. The tagline for her website is "Where the happily ever afters are always in color." So she also maintains, yeah, the Women of Color in Romance blog. So yeah, she is a Black woman. She's amazing. She's got several series that I love. I want to particularly shout out her new adult paranormal queer romance erotica about vampire sorority sisters. What?
What?
Like, y'all.
I mean, those are a dime a dozen. Come on.
Like, I can't even just explain to you, like, how much I love Rebecca Weatherspoon. Like, shout out to her. But she's got something for everybody. She's won multiple awards for both her, like, BDSM series, for her queer series. She just writes amazing women-loving women. You know, what? I can't say enough. My freak out, Rebecca Weatherspoon. Love her. Mwah. Smooches.
Awesome. Okay. I have three freakouts that I'm going to do very quickly.
All right.
Because humble brag, I left my house and I went to things.
Big brag.
All right. First one, I'd mentioned before, Marcela Arguello is a comedian. She did a couple of shows here in San Francisco to record her new album. It was fucking great. She is amazing and hilarious. So one, check her out. Go to her shows. Check out her album when it comes out. Also, friend of the podcast, Irene Too, was opening and emceeing that night, and I had no idea until I got there.
What?
So that was a delightful little moment. Marcela is at Marcela Comedy on Twitter, which we will link. Second event I went to the very next night. Man, I was real tired.
What?
Too much going out. Lucy Bellwood is a cartoonist, and she did 100 days she did 100 days of comics about imposter syndrome that has been collected into a book called 100 Demon Dialogues. She's doing a big tour, so you can check that out. The book is really good. Like, I think we all deal with imposter syndrome. It's something that comes up all the time. And so it's these visuals about this thing that a lot of us feel and experience, I think, is really valuable and great. So the other thing is that she has a little demon in her comics, and you can buy the demon plushie, which, you know, I sure did. So I highly recommend checking all of that out. She's at lucybellwood.com, and you can buy her book and plushie and all of that, and you can find out her tour dates. Third, new hip hop album by Marlo, who the album is it's called Marlo by Marlo. It's a collaboration with L'Orange and Solomon Brigham. I have no idea who any of these people are. I'd never heard of this dude before or these other dudes. It's good. I like it. It has a lot of, like, Mad Lib influence on it. So if you're into hip hop, check that out. Wow. I did it fast. I did my
you
three
did.
Fast.
Bam, bam, bam.
Bam, bam, bam. You know how sometimes I got nothing and then I got too much? Anyways. But we have an extra special freak out because y'all have started sending us your freak outs. So this week we are going to get that started by playing a freak out from Jamie Jeans.
Hello, Ebony, Carolyn, and Anita. I'm Jamie Jeans, and here is my freakout for this week. It is Game Devs and Others, Tales from the Margins, which was edited by Tanya DePass, who currently works on the Spawn on Me podcast, but is best known for the creation of the I Need Diverse Games hashtag. It is a collection of stories and essays from a diverse group of people who talk about how they come to love games, play games, and develop games. There are a number of themes throughout the book that I really enjoyed digging into, such as the frustration over being in an almost entirely straight white male environment, the determination to carve out a space for yourself no matter what, as well as hope for the immense potential of video games as a storytelling and entertainment medium. So please, buy this book. It's great.
All right, you can submit your own freakouts by going to feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's feministfrequency.com/FREQOUT. All right, y'all, that's our show. New episodes come out every single Wednesday, and we're going to be talking about Mission Impossible, Black K-Klansman. I don't know how we're supposed to say it.
It's just black. It's just black,
you weirdo.
Black Klansman.
But it's got to be like Black Klansman.
Black Klansman.
Y'all so white.
Black Klansman.
Like, they showed the preview for that, the trailer for that, before I saw Blind Spotting, along with a Tyler Perry film. Something else. Yep. Like, it was pretty much like all blackness. It was great, right? And the audience that I was watching Blind Spotting with was primarily white. I might have been the only person of color in that entire audience. And two white people got up and walked out.
What? During the trailers?
No, during the movie, you know? But I was like,
shut
from
up.
The trailers to the film, it was too
Maybe
much.
Maybe they were sick or something.
Nah.
I gotta say, I know we're at the end of the show, but I saw Blind Spotting for the premiere in Oakland at the Grand Lake, and I'm just saying that was like the way to fucking see this movie with like all the people who made it. Humble brag, not a humble brag. I was really stoked to do that. We're also gonna talk about Crazy Rich Asians, and these are all the movies that we're talking about coming up.
Next week. This is over across the next few weeks. Next week specifically, if you wanna be down with what we're talking about on that show, it's Mission Impossible Fallout, right? That's what we're doing next week.
I just wanna let y'all know what's coming up so you can be ready.
No, that's great.
You can go check it out.
I just don't want people to feel like, should I have to go watch seven movies to be prepared for next week's Feminist Frequency Radio?
Just watch Mission Impossible, about which I saw someone on Twitter saying that Henry Cavill looked like if Tom of Holland had an office job. And I got my entire life, so...
All right, y'all, remember that we need your help to keep making this show, so please support us at d.rip/femfreak. And if you enjoy this show, please rate and review us on iTunes and tell all of your friends when you're out with them at places that are not your home. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Femfreak and on Instagram at Femfreak to stay up to date on all the news. You can find me at Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
I'm at Oaktown 357.
Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. We'll see y'all next week.
Later. Bye.